G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Adam White, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning, Daniel. A very interesting weekend, particularly yesterday. So many very interesting things took place across a number of sports. So looking forward to talking about that as we reach yet another Monday morning.
How good's Monday? Best day of the week.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Except, of course, for Friday, which is pretty cool too. Last night
and
I was
Saturday
having,
and Sunday, was, they're pretty good too.
Well, Friday builds to Saturday and Sunday. That's why Friday's so special. Friday's special because of the build-up factor to those two magnificent days of Saturday and Sunday, which are so very, very different, of course, to all the others at the moment. Adam Ramanauskas is former Bombers champion and these days manager to the Stars, and he's a big part of the team Mondays and Fridays, speaking of, which funnily enough coincide with our favourite days, Waddy. Rama, good morning to you.
Good morning. Yes, it was a massive weekend. There was so much going on. Two finals that probably didn't live up to the expectations that we're all hoping, but the Shield started back, which was great to see. Dan Ricciardo last night with a third placing in the Grand Prix, and then the dominance of Rafa Nadal. It's simply amazing that you're able to do that to the world number one.
A clinic. Let's start. Just get through the Dan Ricciardo stuff. On the podium at the German Grand Prix behind Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen. Finally, we saw something from Dan that the car saw at the race, which is always a help. always a big help there for Dan. But finally, we saw Dan on the podium, which was great news for him. I'm sure he's very pleased about that. Hasn't been certainly the season that he would like it to be as he prepares to farewell Renault at the end of it, Rama. But a little bit of reward for effort for Aussie Dan.
Well, he's been threatening now for the last few races, so it's a little bit of a reward for effort. But as you said, the car got over the line, I think. I don't think it's been too many mistakes by Dan. It's just the car hasn't held up all that well in the past, and he was able to get there.
So well done to Dan. Just while we're talking motor racing, the MotoGP last night, the French Grand Prix. The French Grand Prix, Remy Gardner in Moto2, our man, finished 8th in the race. And then Jack Miller, the Aussie in the MotoGP, finished 7th at the French Grand Prix. I think he might have started on the front row of the grid, Jack. Just didn't go his way. I think, if I was watching correctly or read correctly in all of that. So a little bit of top 10 action for the boys in the MotoGP and the Moto2 across the weekend as well. In the French Grand Prix. So there's the little bit of motorsport update. We'd like to get Dan on or Jack on. We had Remy, of course, on a couple of weeks ago now, which was a great chat, Whitey, when we had a chat to Remy, but haven't had much luck talking to Jack or Dan through the year, which is a bit of a shame. But we'll keep fighting and keep pushing on and seeing what we could do about that. Remy, you mentioned the Sheffield Shield yesterday. There was a grab that Andrew Mays played on Marnus Labuschagne. Yeah. Who performed really well for Queensland, of course, in the first round of the Shield. If Craig back in the RSN Towers is ready for me, can you just play that again, please, Craig?
Well, this time Labuschagne, he'll find a boundary there, and that will bring up 150. He just keeps making runs.
He just keeps making... Now, Rama, that voice...
Very familiar.
That voice sounded very familiar to me. I can't place it.
Well, it sounds like some new kid sort of on the block sort of style, real excited about cricket being back, but not telling his mates that he was doing it.
That would be disappointing. I don't know who it is, but I wouldn't have thought he'd called too many games, whoever that was, from Gladys Elphick Park in Adelaide.
No.
Why, did you know anything about that?
Gee, sounded like he knew what he was talking about, though, didn't he? Real composure.
He just keeps making runs, he said, that fella. What a learned gentleman.
Real, the voice of cricket, no question. what a strange weekend it was for me. Well, it's quite remarkable, really, because I spent the weekend broadcasting a Queensland versus Tasmania Sheffield Shield game in Adelaide from Melbourne. Work that out.
And not telling anyone about it, particularly the gentleman that you work with.
No, I didn't know I was doing it myself. I didn't know I was doing it myself until about 5 o'clock on Friday night when I was called to say, would you like to well, can you, probably more the point, can you call the cricket for us? So that's what I did. So it was certainly not in the plans. Yeah.
Right.
There you go.
So you're the voice of cricket now, eh? You're the Australian cricket voice. Is that what we're hearing?
Well, it would appear that's the case. No, it was great, actually, because for the first time, Sheffield Shield cricket was on KO. So for those that had KO, you could actually flick between matches and you could sort of, you know, you could watch the Bledisloe Cup, you could watch all sorts of things and be able to watch the Sheffield Shield. So I know from what Cricket Australia was saying over the weekend, there was significantly higher numbers watching Sheffield Shield cricket, which is a good thing. And if you did watch it, you got to see some pretty good cricket, particularly from the likes of Michael Neeser, who took 5 wickets on the first day. Manus Labuschagne batted pretty much the entire day yesterday for 167. And then there was Ashton Agar, who got elevated in the order in Adelaide, playing for Western Australia against South Australia. He got 100 as well. There's some encouraging signs for the first weekend of Sheffield Shield cricket.
Now, love for Josh Inglis?
Well, yes. I mean, he made his debut first-class century, and they put on 270-odd, which is sort of in the top six, sixth wicket partnership in Sheffield Shield history. So, yes, he did very well as well. But the Agar one, I think, is quite significant because he got pushed up into the top six, which enabled them to play another bowler. So rather than Agar batting at 7 or 8, which is what he usually does, usually 8, he got put up to 6. And when he got to the crease, they were in trouble. So for him to do what he did, I think he's quite significant.
So let me get this straight. You're on the couch, tracky dacks on, headset on, hand down your pants, calling the cricket on the telly. Is that what you're saying? Is that what was going on?
Pretty
Al
much.
Al Bundy style.
Al Bundy style. That's what I pictured, Rammer.
I had to go to an establishment to do it.
Oh,
so there was some semblance of professionalism. I actually had to leave the residence, which was quite unfamiliar. And, didn't get out particularly well at home. But Emma was happy. She was happy. But the kids weren't too pleased. You sort of come to the realisation that I've just been playing with kids and doing not much else for 6 months. And it's a big day for a lot of families today because kids go back to school.
My word, they do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
My word,
they do.
There's some joy in this household, don't you worry about that. Off your trot, Wilbur. Off your trot. Have a great day. Don't call me.
Well, it was kinder last week, and now it's school this week. So it's going to be a very different feel in our house. And I know that's going to be the case in your house and in a number of houses around town.
This is how keen I was, half and whitey. I made them pack their school bags on Saturday morning. Just get everything organised, get your uniform out, polish your school shoes, just get ready.
Oh, yeah, school shoes. No, we didn't get to that.
It was, just quickly, and I know there's plenty of other things to talk about, but it was quite remarkable yesterday watching Manus Labuschagne play, considering how many runs he's made over the last couple of years. It was actually his first Sheffield Shield 100 in over 2 years. But he had this really bad patch just before lunch. And so during the luncheon break, rather than having a bit of a rest and having something to eat, he took Andy Bickle and he went to the nets and had a throwdown during the lunch break because he wasn't happy with how he was playing. He changed his bat and went on, made 167. So he's about, I can't remember now exactly what he was, but he was about sort of 40 or 50 not out at lunch, but had been dropped 3 times in about 20 minutes.
And, so that doesn't count.
Yeah.
In a way, it doesn't.
Whitey, did you find it interesting that he batted at 3 and Khawaja batted at 4? Now, I know Khawaja's captain,
Well, I think this is the part of the deal with Khawaja. Now he's captain. It's actually not necessarily about him. So Manus bats number 3 for Australia. That's where he wants to bat. And so that's where he batted. And the irony of it all is that Khawaja, who is now his captain, I mean, Manus took his spot in the test team. And there they were yesterday batting. And unfortunately for Usman, he got a pretty ordinary LBW decision and he was out cheaply. But, you know, that's how it goes now. So it was a good test for Labuschagne. It was good batting conditions. But Tasmania had Siddle, Bird, Meredith, and Ellis. Now, Meredith and Ellis are more known as sort of big bash bowlers that sort of, you know, they bowl really quickly. But they, you know, they're getting their opportunity at the moment in red ball cricket. But it was a high-quality attack. It was just pretty slow pitch, good batting conditions, and Labuschagne took the most of it, particularly after lunch, and batted extremely well.
All right, that's the cricket update. A little bit, two games going on. Lloyd Pope, Pfeiffer, the first five wicket to the match, which I think is the first time it's ever been done, or been done for over 100 years by a spinner in a Shield game on day one. Which is a good bit. If it, funnily enough, it was the only, well, the only wickets for the innings when WA declared five for 6,642.
Yeah, that's right. He took the first five, and then that's all they took, and he got a bit of tap as well towards the end. Hey, we're talking to Chris Rogers later on.
We are.
And there's real intrigue going on over there at the moment because they can't train in any more than groups of four. And they've got a social distance while they're training in groups of four. So there's now a strong suggestion that Victoria won't play nearly as many games over in the Adelaide hub as was going to be the case. So I'm really interested in talking to Chris to see exactly what's happening for them, because it's going to make a huge impact on their season if they can't play as many games as they were hoping in South Australia.
No doubt. Now, by the way, Rama, you're the winner of the Friday Face-Off. Well done to you on the weekend. Just the one-pointer.
Yeah, a little one-pointer. Yeah,
a little one-pointer. Little ticket over. Keep the thing just down the... Chain strike. Just down to the final leg for one. Bashir Hawley with most kicks, which means Noel Kay from Burwood wins the $100 voucher for Rabiras at Swallows. When we're allowed to get out of the house, it's going to be awesome. There's going to be a real run on Rabiras at Swallows once this 5K thing gets lifted, Rama.
It's going to be a real run. Queue. I will definitely be in the queue to go in there.
My word, my word. Now, we're going to speak to Craig Gable about Rafa, so we won't go too hard on the tennis situation, but that was quite remarkable. Did you watch the Bledisloe yesterday?
I saw the last 15 minutes, and it was unbelievable.
Well, that
theatre,
was all,
just theatre.
That was all you needed to watch, really, for the theatre component. Mm. It was unbelievable. The Wallabies... If I'd have asked you yesterday who was the coach of the Wallabies, would you have been able to answer me?
No, no. I couldn't remember his name.
Yeah. I
knew he's new.
I think that sums up a bit of the whole Wallabies situation at the moment and where they are in the sporting landscape in Australia, which is so very, very sad. We were discussing this on the WhatsApp chat yesterday. For the show. It's so very, very sad what has become of the Wallabies, which was such a presence, such a dominant presence in Australian sport for decades, that have just sort of fallen off the radar. Dave Rennie was in charge for the first time yesterday, and 16-all in New Zealand was a remarkable outcome, and we're okay. Now, there's a couple of moments that we wouldn't like to see it again, and I'm sure New Zealand would like the ground of that try just before half-time. Just add a few more points on the board. But remarkably, a really strong performance from the Wallabies. I'm keen to try and get someone a little bit later on in the morning to have a chat about it, because not only was it a great performance, and they need some credit for that against the mighty All Blacks, but it's got to be, they've got to find a way to make this the foundation of building the Wallabies back to a brand in this country and finding a real stronghold in the sporting scene.
Well, I didn't even know they were playing, to be honest.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, and until
you
told me they were playing.
On the couch.
No, but what the point is, Half, is that usually you know when the Wallabies are playing, and that, you know, they've gone off the radar a lot in recent years, and for a number of reasons. One is they haven't been particularly good, but two, just rugby union in general has gone off the radar, and they've had their own issues internally, and it's just not front of mind anymore. And so to do what they did, because no one expected them to even get close, because they're a relatively new team. Not only is the coach new, but they had quite a few debutants and a lot of inexperience in that side. And they had that penalty opportunity to go in front in extra time from the other side of halfway. And while the breeze was there for Reece Hodge, he clearly kicked it well, and it hit the upright and stayed in play, which meant that the game kept going, and it went for an additional 8 or 9 minutes. It looked like Australia were going to score. It looked like there was a missed penalty there at one point. Then it went down the other end. New Zealand, I couldn't believe they didn't score. They were right on the line. They couldn't get over. And Australia in the end thought, through James O'Connor, you know what? we can't hold on any longer. I'm just going to kick it out of play and take the draw, which is what they did.
It was a massive roost, that one from Rhys Hodge, wasn't it? And I know, as you said, the breeze was behind him.
Huge.
It was a massive roost. And it hit the post sort of three-quarters of the way up. It was going for another 20 metres.
Did you notice that he didn't have much of a run-up either? It was like a... I mean, he has obviously a set routine, but it was almost like a three- or four-step run-up before the connection.
Jared
for someone that was having to kick the ball, such a long way, I wasn't sure he was going to have enough momentum through the ball.
Well, that's one of the myths. I think it's one of the myths of goal kicking in the AFL. You've got to have this long, balanced run-up. It's all about your last three steps. And these guys in the rugby league and rugby union show you that that's exactly what you need. It's balance at the point of impact and force at the point of impact rather than this 55-metre run-up that wiggling the ball around, all this sort of stuff.
Like your man, Ben Brownrammer.
Well, it works for him. He's only been the most accurate kicker for goal. So, anyway. But that's Josh Kennedy, West Coast. He takes those stutter steps and then his last couple of steps balances out and off he goes. But I want to ask both of you guys a question. In terms of the Australian teams, when you think of the Australian teams right now that you want to watch, where do the Wallabies rank?
Well, no, they would have been right down the bottom up until yesterday.
Mm. Obviously, the Australian cricket team's number one for the high majority of us. But I'm just trying to think now. Like, I agree with Whitey. It used to be, when the Wallabies played, it used to be must-watch. Even though we live in Melbourne and we're not rugby union fans, it's just must-watch because it's an Australian team. But now, like Whitey said, you know, I was only looking through Twitter yesterday morning to realise that the game was actually on.
Well, I think the other part of that, Rammer, is...
I remember driving around Ireland watching the Wallabies won the World Cup, England and Ireland, whenever that was back in...
Yep.
Oh, who knows when it was. Anyway, it was a long time ago now. I remember driving around Ireland watching them, following them and watching them through a couple of games in that campaign. And it was the best thing, just being a part of the whole roadshow. And now it was a World Cup, so it was pretty exciting, full stop. But being watching the Wallabies, and we stayed in one of the hotels with them and just hanging out with them, so to speak, without hanging out with them, just watching them move around the hotel. They were the coolest. They were rock stars, the Wallabies, back then.
Were they being involved in a spring tour when they were doing that?
No, World Cup.
Oh, World Cup. Right, okay. Well, I think the thing I was going to say about the Wallabies is that, I mean, I don't particularly like the sport because I can't handle the technical side of it. Like, they're all in there jumping on top of each other, and then all of a sudden there's a penalty and no one knows, including the players, what it's for. And that was the tension I thought that was there in that last sort of 10 or 15 minutes, is that you were just worried that someone was going to make a mistake which was going to result in a penalty straight in front of goal, and that was going to determine the result. But what was the case for a number of years in rugby was that there were household names that were playing, and lots of them. They were iconic names in Australian sport, not just in rugby. Now, I'll be honest with you, I can only name a handful, if that, of players that play rugby union now for Australia. And it's a little bit like that with the Socceroos as well, I reckon. I don't think they've been particularly good at promoting themselves and the athletes that represent their country. So we can actually get that emotional attachment in a place like Victoria where and Tasmania as well, where they're not the main sport. So you need to have a much better connection with the stars of the game to get you to follow. And the coach goes into that category as well.
Yeah, well, the new coach is obviously not going to be as well known because of the situation. But you're right. Even leading up into the last couple of weeks, I mean, there's been a little dribs and drabs of news floating out of the camp and the build-up to the clash. But nowhere near the promotion that it used to get the Bledisloe Cup and the Wallabies New Zealand in clashes. I mean, goodness gracious me, they were the highlights of the calendar for many, many years, weren't they?
Yeah. Yep, no doubt. Did you see the presentation after the game that the All Blacks made to our captain?
No, I did not.
Well, he played his
100th... pretty quick.
Yeah, well, he played his 100th test. This was on Twitter. But in the rooms together, presented Michael Hooper with a bottle of wine. And it's just great to see that sportsmanship. After the game, they've gone at it for 80-plus minutes, and then, you know, they're presenting him a bottle of wine to congratulate him, but then they're also having a couple of beers together afterwards and chatting away. And, you know, that's the stuff that I love seeing that. You go out there and you battle away for
for such a long period of time. But then you can have a beer afterwards and talk about the game, and whatever happened, you leave it out on the field.
Yeah, all for that. Once the battle is done, the battle is done. I'm big on that. Very big on that. Before we get to the break, you had talking about Sunday being a big day, Whitey. What else were you referring to?
Well, I was mentioning Nadal, who had his 20th win, which we'll get to with Craig Gabriel afterwards. I do want to mention the golf as well. Tyrrell Hatton won a fifth European Tour title overnight. It was a four-shot win in the big the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth.
Is that different than the significance?
That's a big. That's right. That's exactly
just
right.
Different brands.
That's exactly right. He won a wind cheater and some comfortable tracksuit pants and a free pack of undies for his victory.
And some imitation Tupperware.
That's exactly right. But it's significant because it now puts him in the world's top 10. And what he does is that when he gets himself into winning positions, he wins a lot. In recent times, and he's always been seen as a sort of a bit of a crazy guy, the way he sort of can completely combust, and he yells and screams and chucks clubs and does all the things that a lot of us do when we play golf. But he has a real personality about him, and what I love about him is he's not afraid to win, which was certainly the case again at Wentworth. Now, this is a guy that won in Turkey last year when he chipped in to stay involved in a playoff. He won his maiden PGA title earlier this year in the Arnold Palmer. So this guy is a serious player. And I don't think too many people would have thought that 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I think he was always just going to be a bit of a journeyman. But he's now a serious winner. And he put a really strong field to the sword. He won really comfortably. He birdied, I think it was 9, 10 and 11 through the middle part of his round. And no one could go with him.
Craig Gabriel loves this game, and he knows all the big stars in town, not only on the tennis circuit, but on the entertainment circuit as well across the globe. Craig, good morning.
Morning.
Can you tell me how old Hugh Jackman is, please?
Well, I can, because the night before last, I had an email from Deborah Lee Furness saying, remember, it's Hugh's birthday. So I'd forgotten, actually. And he's 52.
Oh, you've done it again. You've done it again. You got an email from Deborah Lee.
I'm not sure what Deb and Oscar and Ava, the kids, I don't know what they're doing for Hugh's birthday today, but I'm sure it'll be very nice, a bit of a family affair.
So a question for all of you. What was the television show where Deborah Lee Furness and Hugh Jackman found that real energy and became an item and went on and became life partners?
Yeah, it was an Australian soap opera, wasn't it, or something like that?
Well, I'm not sure whether you call it a soap opera. I'd describe it more as a drama.
No idea.
Yeah, I can't remember now. Yeah, I mean...
Corelli.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, that's right.
No.
Never heard of that.
But you know what he's
going to be on? Felt a bit flat, didn't it, really?
What he's going to be his next show on Broadway is, which is a great musical, The Music Man.
Oh, yeah, I'm all over that. Yeah, let's get into that sort of stuff.
That one, that'd be great. I mean, originally, I think Robert Preston played the lead role in The Music Man, and he is going to be amazing in it. But I still think, I never watched the Wolverine movies. It's not my cup of tea. I don't like those sort of movies, but he didn't take kindly to when I mentioned that. But he was so good as Jean Valjean, and he should probably.
Yes.
We got an Oscar nomination, but he enamored the whole cast. I remember Anne Hathaway telling me that he is such a nice guy. He's even got nice feet. Would you believe that's the comment she made? But she won an Oscar for it. But yeah.
Yeah, Les Miserables was a ripper, yes. A bit of Russell Crowe action in that one as well. And you and Anne, as you say, playing the key roles there. Now, the key role yesterday was with Novak and with Rafael Nadal in the French Open final. But really, it wasn't much of an event. It was a two-star affair because Rafa was too good.
Rafa was amazing. 6 love, 6-2-7-5 in 2 hours, 41 minutes. I mean, for the set, two and a half sets, he was almost untouchable. And then he'd broken serve to go up 3-2 in the third set. little bit of a dodgy game, service game he played. Novak came back in, and I think a lot of people were thinking, oh, look, this is going to start getting a little bit tense. But then, you know, you still had that feeling that Rafa was just waiting for the next little opportunity, and it came. Djokovic was a bit shaky, and Rafa broke him to go up 6-5 and then served out the match. And what an ace that match point was. It was just brilliant stuff. I mean, you know, he fell to his knees on the court and just absolutely was so excited and thrilled with that result because there was so much behind it. I mean, when you look at these stats, 100th match win at Roland Garros, only 100 just at Roland Garros, and what a time to hit the century in the final. His 13th Roland Garros, the French Open title, and now he's equal to Roger Federer for the most majors amongst the men at 20.
That's going to kill Roger. He's not going to be happy with that, Craig. Well, he's not going to be happy.
This is what's so amazing, because Roger was on social media pretty much straight after congratulating him and made the point, this is probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, achievement in sport on what Rafa has done with the 13th French titles. And both of them, they're actually pretty good friends. So Rafa was pretty humbled and touched by Roger's comments. And what I also think is interesting, from the time that Roger won his first major, which was Wimbledon in 2003, he's always been ahead of Rafa for the number of majors. Now they're joint.
Yeah. I mean, look, we've talked about this a lot, Craig, over the years about who's going to be seen as the better player and all those sorts of things. And it would appear that Nadal will probably go past Roger, and I think Novak will go past as well.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about it, from my perspective, was Nadal, because he also, like Roger, has an understanding of history and doesn't forget things. And he referenced the fact that Djokovic had belted him in the Australian Open final a couple of years ago. And I'm not suggesting that he wanted revenge, but it was certainly in his mind as he was playing that game last night that he was really going to put him away.
Yeah, look, he did hint that some of that was in his mind, but he wasn't going out, as he made it clear, I was not going out for revenge. It just fell into place and everything worked out. I mean, the first game, that's when everything happened because Djokovic had an opportunity to hold serve over there, but then he starts playing these stupid drop shots, and so many of them that it was just like, here's a red, you know, I'll fly the red flag and I'm going to hit a drop shot. And Nadal was just picking them. And then he just, you know, ran away with it.
We love Jimmy's magic. He helps us out on a Monday morning, reflecting on the weekend that was semi-final weekend in the AFL. James, a good morning to you.
Morning, Daniel. It's and everybody else. It's put your bike helmets out. It's for the Magpies, you know, the bike helmets with all the little spokey dokies that come out for the swooping. So... stand by your pies for Joey. Yeah, put your bike helmets out, take a photo, put it on social media, get behind them and get them to the off season.
Yeah, cable ties everywhere on the helmets today. They'll be up and about hanging out hanging out your helmets. It's good. It's good. It's a nice sentiment, Jim, because our man's going through a bit of pain.
Yeah, it'd be tough. And look, this is always the difficulty now as a list management group. And half, I know you and I have spoken about this a fair bit, and Rama would be great to talk to, is how much do you weigh up the season on that last performance? Like, you got absolutely touched up, and this always happens. Like, the same happened with the Giants when they got belted in the grand final. Other teams have been beaten convincingly in the finals. How much do you weigh up the last game as what you're missing and what do you need to do to go forward? Or do you, you know, completely ignore that and weigh up the whole entire season as a whole, because the finals is where it really matters, isn't it?
That is correct. That's why they play.
It's a very good question.
So let's go back before we get to that. Let's go back to Friday night with Richmond and St Kilda. We'll play the same sentiment, Jim. What would St Kilda be reflecting upon today? What's Brett Ratton and co reflecting upon today after the season that was for them? By the way, Jack Steele announced as their Trevor Barker a medalist last night, the best and fairest for the Saints.
yeah, that was probably the easiest, best and fairest to pick for quite some time. He was absolutely absolutely brilliant. It'd be like after the game, here, Jack, can you just pack the best and fairest? Do they get a medal or a trophy, the Trevor Barker medal?
They're all medals these days.
Yeah, take that and the pizza voucher with you, as it used to be at Bell Park. get yourself a free large. Now, I think this is the reason why I raised it, I think they're different conversations between St Kilda and Collingwood, because the Saints, you could just say, well, the game plan was fine. We just didn't have Carlisle, Ryder, Long, actually personnel, because I actually think the Saints' game plan works and they've got the personnel to execute their game plan. They could maybe just add a player or two. You can always add quality to help with your game plan. Whereas I think Collingwood, there's still a bit of game system forward of the ball, the way they move the footy, and I don't think that's just a this year issue. It's been an issue for them since they've won the grand final. You go through their players, Thomas, Hoskin Elliott, DeGoey, and I'm missing the other... Oh, Stevenson. They all kicked 40 in the year they made the grand final, and I don't think all four have really hit the height since that grand final year.
No, spot on. I think that's fair. I think that's fair. So you're saying Secura on the up, and we'll get to the Magpies a little bit later on in more depth, but they're on the way down. But the Saints can be well pleased with what they've been able to achieve in 2020.
I wouldn't say up or down. I'd say the way you'd look at it and the way you'd assess it with the question I asked is whether it was list or game style when you review your season.
I think Jimmy and Rama and Daniel, St Kilda have done a lot of really good things over the last 12 months. And I think even in the final series, the two games they've played, it's almost franked what they've been able to achieve. And I think what they've gone and done is they've gone and got a really good coach who's put in a game plan that works, as you touched on, Jimmy. If you look at their best and fairest, the top three are all relatively new recruits. So it's another example of how that they've got their trading and their list management right. And I think if you look forward as well, is that they've now created an environment and a list that if you were looking at potentially going to a new club, you'd look at that and you think, you know what, they're on the right track. I can see what they're trying to do. So, yeah, they could add, but I reckon they've got a lot of the components pretty good. And it's quite a balanced sort of list. And I thought, guys, on Friday night, while Richmond always seemed to be in control, there was a time there in the third quarter where St Kilda got a little bit close, and you start to think, geez, they're going all right here, the Saints. Richmond haven't quite put them away here. They kept coming, even though they perhaps weren't playing as well as they have at other times during the course of the year. But it seems that they're a team that have got a lot more scope in them.
Yeah, well, they kept pushing on Friday night. Actually, the one that you missed is Gresham, who didn't play for a large part of the season because of that back injury. So he comes in and adds to the midfield and the forward half. But it's a sustainable game plan that St Kilda have, I think, which is what they get out of that season. I think a lot of Saints supporters would have been scratching their heads over previous years, just wondering how they play because of the inconsistency in their performance. Now, inconsistency comes with immaturity as well. So, you know, they're starting to get mature performances now out of Jack Steele, who's a best and fairest winner, Billings, Dougal Howard comes in. So there's a number of guys that are naturally maturing and getting older, and that's why you get consistency in performance. But I actually think St Kilda will be a touch disappointed with Friday night, because I never thought they had a period of, 10 minutes, let's call it 15 minutes within that game, where they actually got the game on their terms and they were playing with any dash or dare. Richmond seemed to be able to really stifle that type of play. I didn't feel, and this is both finals, I didn't feel like they were, both those finals were at finals intensity. If you compare them to the four games of the previous week, and if you look at the two games of this weekend, it didn't really have the... Now, the Collingwood-Geelong game was over within the first 10 minutes, but I didn't feel the Friday night game. I think the one thing that Brett Ratten would be most disappointed on, he didn't bring the heat. They didn't bring the pressure to Richmond.
But isn't that just I agree with you, but that's just the reality of the fact that the top four were clearly the top four this year.
No doubt.
And if you go to the first week of the finals, the two qualifying finals were really exceptional games of football, and the Bulldogs and Kilda game was close, and the West Coast Collingwood game were close, but there weren't high-quality matches compared to the other two. And then we see this weekend, we thought there may have been a monkey on the back of Geelong because of their finals record. Well, Geelong started well, game over. And Richmond are just a better team. But I do think that St Kilda would take a lot of confidence out of what they did throughout the course of the year.
100% they'll take a lot of confidence.
They're just not good enough to beat the top four.
So the question really is, and they'll be having their list management meetings today, is how do we improve? Now, if you sit on your hands and rely on natural improvement of your list, you'll only get a spike of maybe 5%, 10%. They've got to look at and really analyse, well, what do we actually need to add now? Do we need to try to bring in another player from another club, or do we think we're simply good enough? And that's a question that all clubs will ask.
Well, one of the things that stood out to me, and Jim, I get your take on this too, was one of the players that they could least afford to lose in the game against Richmond was Paddy Ryder. And of course, he hit that hamstring late in the game against, who did they play in their first week? With the Bulldogs. Turns out to be a pretty nasty outcome for them and their season in that game on Friday night, because they got monstered out of the centre. Now, it's not just about the ruck and the tap work. 15-5 out of the centre clearances. Where stop it around the ground, the Saints had their way, but the centre clearances where they lost all field position. 15-5 is a smacking, let alone in a semi final.
Rammer, I thought you're going to jump in there, Rammer. But
you go first, Jim. I want to just touch on something else with Paddy Ryder after you, Jim.
Yeah. Well, they lost their point of difference, didn't they? Really, it was the two ruck combo, the two headed monster, which two legitimate ruckmen. We're not talking about that big banana who just stands in the forward line, comes in and does 5 minutes, or you grabbing a guy from another position to fill in for the ruck. That was their point of difference. Two legitimate ruckmen, and the difference is Paddy Ryder against, when you look at the Bulldogs, what they could do in the centre bounce with Paddy Ryder, like, because he can legitimately get over the top. He can push the ball forward, he can push it to those forward hits. As soon as they get that going, they start knocking them laterally or pulling them back where the players have got space. Whereas Marshall, not yet, it doesn't quite have that capability. They tend to go to a hit zone where they just outnumber an area in the circle and they try and hit 2-1. So it's a bit of point of difference that they lost there. But they also, we touched on this a little bit and just continuing on with the Saints chat, is just fundamentals hurt them at the key times. You think about when they had a couple of minute patch, I think it was the third quarter when they were going to the right of screen. You know, they switch the ball out of defence, they get going really quick. Dean Kent wheels onto his left foot, has Billings charging towards the goal square, and he kicks the ball along the ground. Now, when you're playing big finals like that, you've just got to execute the fundamentals, and that's where the pressure comes from to put on to Richmond. But you're right, Ramit. Richmond put the pressure on, which then forces those errors, which are routine, like Dean Kent wheeling onto his left foot to kick someone wide open inside forward 50. But the ball, he kicks it all the way along the ground. Like, that's just pressure.
The other part with Ryder not playing, what it caused is forward of the ball a real issue. So the stoppages we touched on. But then if you look at the intercept possessions for Richmond, so Caulfield was the leader in the game. He had 9 intercepts, and he was terrific again, Caulfield. Mm. Top 5 in their best and fairest as well, by the way, last night. So he had a terrific year. But then you look at the next lot of players. Vlosten 6, Grimes 6, Baker 6, Hawley 6, Broad 6. All defenders. So the ball going inside forward 50 without having Marshall or Ryder there, because Marshall had to ruck, obviously, one out for the entire game. It was easy pickings for Richmond's defence. Really, really easy pickings.
And there's sort of an extra layer to that as well, I reckon, with St Kilda forward of the ball. They kicked 6 goals, 13. They missed a lot of clutch shots, and they also dropped a few important marks inside 50 at important times. And if you reference back to that game against West Coast, where they needed to win that to guarantee them spot in the finals, which is their second last game, they kicked 6-14 that night as well. And it's that same thing, I reckon, about, and that's why I was a bit unsure about St Kilda, was their ability to get the job done under pressure. Now, I know they've come from a long way back, but I reckon forward of the ball, they could still do some tinkering to their list to make them a bit better.
You just listed a couple of fundamentals of the game again, Waddy. Goal kicking,
yeah.
Marking the ball.
So does that come from more experienced guys of being in those moments on a more regular basis, or does it actually mean that they've got to just change it up a little bit, potentially?
No, experience helps. Experience definitely helps.
Got to live it to learn it.
Yep.
And they've lived a bit like Brisbane did last year. They rectified a few things in their first final against Richmond as well.
No, that's a good call.
You've got to live it to learn it, I reckon. I'm a big believer in that philosophy in just about anything. First time you do it, you'll never be as good as... Well, rarely would you be as good as the second time, third time, fourth time. And the more you do it, the more comfortable you are, the more you understand those moments and what they are, and you get better. And especially when you're dealing with a collective. It's not just one player. You're not playing tennis.
No.
You're dealing with 22 humans who are very, very different, who have different levels of anxiety and experience and capability of dealing with all that, Rammer. And it's the art of a great team. It's why we admire great teams, because all that coming together is a very, very special thing.
I agree with what you're saying, Half, about living it to learn it. But the fundamentals that Jim talking about, they're ingrained in you for it. You should have dropped marks like that. And I get the pressure, and there's a little bit of dew and all that sort of stuff. But that needs to be a footballer's bread and butter. They can't.
It's the moments, remember. It's the expectation. It's the weight of the outcome. Whereas round 16, it doesn't matter. Like, you drop that mark and you lose a game, it doesn't matter, effectively. But if you drop a semi-final, and you do, it's all over.
I'm talking about though, doing the fundamentals day in, day out, week in, week out, so you get to those moments in a final and you don't fail at them. Like, you look at, for example, okay, you go to Saturday night, Darcy Cameron drops that simple chest mark in the forward pocket. Like, that's day in, day out stuff. That's not a moment. That's what you've got to live as a footballer, to do that every single day. You're a professional. You don't drop those, Jim.
Yeah, but that's the what separates just the good and average players to the best players. It's not a special formula or things like that. There's a reason why Gary Ablett and Joel Selwood and these sort of guys, Scott Pendlebury in particular, they're just so sound with their fundamentals. They don't fumble. They don't drop marks. The one is a bugbear of mine, and this is, almost like an old footy coach within me. Handballs behind players that doesn't, where they have to stop and come back, or the devaluing of a handball, which goes straight into the ground. As soon as you handball into the ground, you just invite the pressure. It's that getting back off the mark. The amount of times I see players who just stand there, and the man on the mark's a metre away, and they wonder why they kick it up a chimney. Like, all that sort of stuff.
Do you think, Rama, just with St Kilda, I probably shouldn't ask you. Actually, I'll ask Jimmy this question. If you put Ben Brown in St Kilda's forward line, and then all of a sudden you've got a scenario where Membry's taking the second defender, King's taking the third, does that make it a better-looking St Kilda forward line? And those players play, it makes it easier for them to play their role rather than them be one and two?
It means King has to play a little bit out further, which is okay, and Membry has to play out a little bit further.
Which I think suits both of them.
Yeah, which also means, can Ben Brown find the space without having to work over his opponent? So Ben Brown goes on these long searching leads and he turns them around, gets back to the goal square. Look, it can work. It just depends on ball movement up forward and also what you've got around. Because then if you've got King and Brown... And Membry's okay at ground level. You really need some dynamic players around them, don't you? It can
work. They've got.
Yeah, it can work.
Don't know if I want that lineup. I'm not sure. It might be a bit cumbersome.
I'm not 100% on it, but it can work, definitely.
I think there's a better fit. I think there's a better fit for Ben than the Saints at the moment.
I'm probably asking that with King. I mean, he's so young. Does he need more support? Is he ready to be that main man in a final to kick five goals, or is he, or four goals, or is he? Would Ben Brown help King be a better player?
I think you need a bit more of a Paulie King key poster than the Ben Brown style.
I think Ben gets himself in situations where you kick it to him. I just think it looked like he looked like a 19, 20-year-old body. That's the only thing that cost him. It wasn't the fact that he wasn't going at the contest. He wasn't making his way into it. It was hands on the footy, and just by his pure not being as mature or physical as his direct opponent, who the last second was able to get a spoil him. I think you add another another pre-season onto him. Some of those drop balls end up being marks because he doesn't get his arms chopped or just nudged at the right time.
Let's have a look at the Tigers, the winners. 52 inside 50s, I think it was, Rammer, for the Tigers. You're not going to lose too many games if you're rich when you're getting that number of inside 50s, because they get in there with real speed. That's one of the things about the Tigers. Their numbers in that area aren't necessarily always massive, but they're efficient. And we knew pretty early doors that it was going to be a big night. Tom Lynch ends up kicking 2-5. He could have kicked whatever he could have kicked and really blown the game to pieces. He was a huge presence in that area of the ground. But Asher Hawley, your man for the Friday face-off, was outstanding. Dusty, Sean Edwards, Shane Edwards. McIntosh kicked the goal again as that floating offside winger. Just a really impressive, it was almost powerful performance from Richmond on Friday night.
I thought the one in the first quarter was Shea Bolton. Just his two goals in that first quarter just opened the game. His second goal was out of his backside. So, yeah, I couldn't believe that. How he was able to crumb it off the pack, basically juggle it in his hands, and then slap it on the right boot for a check side goal. That opened the game. That was a really late one. Shane Edwards, you mentioned, you know, his underground kick to a goal. I was sort of thinking last week watching him against Brisbane, I just thought, you know, the undisciplined play that they had, you know, giving away 50-metre penalties, so many free kicks. You sort of thought, Richmond play on the edge, but are they going a little bit too far here? But I thought Friday night, they looked every bit like they can win it. I don't think they go now to Port Adelaide with any fears. You look when they played Port Adelaide last time, everyone calls it the game of the year. It was a super game. Port win by 21 points, but Port Adelaide smashed them in every statistical area in that game. Richmond obviously had some personnel out. I know Port Adelaide had some personnel out, but Friday night, they played a game where they just didn't allow the opposition any chance to win that game. Whitey mentioned St Kilda had a little small period in that third quarter where they slightly pushed, but I thought it was a clinical final performance as I've seen in a long time from the Tigers.
Well, until the next 24 hours, of course.
Yeah.
From the Tigers, yeah, fair enough.
Rammer and Jimmy have both played in dominant teams. Are there any times where you aren't not necessarily searching for motivation, but you almost maybe get a bit bored or get a bit complacent? Because that performance against Brisbane looked like a team that needed a slap around the chops, and we talked about that being the case before the game was played, and then they played like a team that was much more focused, a lot sharper against St Kilda. Was it as simple as that? I'm not saying they needed the loss, but just to sharpen them up a bit?
No, I don't think they needed the loss. Sometimes you can be a little bit off and flat, and it can look like you're a little bit lethargic in your performance. But they've had sort of personnel come in and out as well throughout the side, and sometimes just getting that little bit of connection back. Brisbane were absolutely super. They had the intensity. They were playing the home final, home crowd. They had just that little bit of extra zip about them. But Richmond were still up in it to their eyeballs. You know, if the Shea Bolton one, you know, where he bananaed from the pocket, if that goes through, you'd actually think, well, geez, I think Richmond might get home here because all the momentum was going their way. So, no, I don't think it was boredom or things like that. I know being part of my cat side, and Rammer would have been the same with that dominant Essence side, it's actually the opposite. You get this motivation that you actually want to crush an opposition. There's nothing greater than just knowing you actually, it sounds brutal, but that's the mindset you have, is I absolutely want to destroy this club. Like, and this might sound really, really bad. I hope people get sacked from that club because we beat them so badly. Like, you've got that pure... Like, I'm trying to put you in the mind of that intensity. Yeah, you know what I mean? That mind of that intensity of, I just want this to turn into a recurring nightmare. So every single time they play the Cats, they're going, Oh, geez, not again. Like, you've already got them a little bit on the back foot next time you play them.
Well, the killer mentality coming out in
detail. The late great Bailey will be sitting up in heaven at the moment, sort of just laughing at you, Jim, at the moment. But we got complacent once.
Sorry, can I answer? I reckon there was probably 3 years in a row where Melbourne came down to Cadinia Park and they went home with a staff member less.
Yeah. Yeah. Brutal.
That's fair. Now, Huff, we got complacent once in finals campaigns. It was against what we thought was a rubbish Hawthorn team in 2001, and they nearly got over the line.
Rammer, did they have those that check jumper and half a year?
We're hoping that Chris Rogers does awesome things with the Victorian Shield team. That's what we're hoping. The brand new coach.
What do you mean you hope he will?
Well, he hasn't done anything yet, so we're hoping. What do you mean? What do I mean? He hasn't had a chance to get out there and get him in anger. He's got to wait another 10 days, I think it is, before they take on the Blues in the first of the Sheffield Shield games after quarantine. He joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, guys. A bit like you, Huff. Haven't coached a game yet. Hey, got to wait and get it done.
That's right. It's not. But are you excited? Are you anticipating a good result when you do get that chance, Chris?
Well, I'm hopeful, I guess. yeah. I think we're going pretty well, but we'll be a couple of games behind everybody else when we do play. But we've no doubt got the talent. We've just got to go out and play well. But everyone seems to be in a pretty good space. So, yeah, hoping for a good result.
Is it an advantage or a disadvantage to have that little sighter on the competition with those couple of games you'll be behind, as you said?
Oh, who knows? I mean, it's good to kind of see what's happening out there, but equally, I think that, you know, there's no substitute for playing as well. So these guys will have a couple of games under their belt when we come up against them. Hopefully there's a couple of injuries, but no, not really. Hopefully, yeah, they we catch them on the hop, but yeah, there's a few more weeks to go. We should be right by that first game.
So, Chris, what's happening at the moment from a training perspective? Because we're hearing that you're only allowed to train in groups of four and there's got to be social distancing even in that group of four. Can you train as well as you need to be able to train to be prepared, or might you have to push some games back?
Yeah, so it looks like we're only going to play two games here. We originally were going to play three. The quarantine measures didn't look as bad originally, and then they got changed about 4 or 5 days leading into the quarantine. So from looking at that, we just thought we weren't going to be able to prepare well enough, because we are training in groups of four. We only get a short rotation in the net, as everyone has to share that. So, yeah, just in terms of, particularly with our young fast bowlers, getting enough balls into them for them to be resilient enough to play a first class game, we just felt we weren't quite right. So we've pushed it back. We're only going to play two games, which is a bit disappointing, but yeah, probably for the betterment of the squad.
So how does that? Oh, you might not even know the answer to this, but how will then your season look if you're only going to play two when other teams will have played as many as four? Will you just worry about that later in the season, or is there sort of a plan in place?
Yeah, I mean, originally, well, now it looks like it's going to be a 9-game season. I'm not sure if I'm divulging secret information here, but I think it's going to be around 9 games. So we have to play 7 after the BBL, which is going to be it's going to be challenging as well. But, you know, you just have to ride with it at the moment. I think with everything that's going on in the world, we just have to be prepared to be flexible and we'll deal with that when we come across it.
You must be frustrated in the sense that you got some good games or some good playing time into the guys at Junction Oval before you left, and then you have this little bit of a lull. And I know it's the way of the world, but you're seeing some good signs from what I understand from what they'd done before you left.
Yeah, I reckon we were probably ready to go last week, actually, which is a bit of a shame. And yeah, we were fortunate enough. There was that pretty good period of weather in Melbourne. We could get outside and we played. We must have had about 7, 8, 9 days out on Junction Oval outside. So, a lot of the players got what they needed, really, and the bowlers had bowled quite a lot. So I thought we were ready to go, and there was a lot of really good signs, particularly from a lot of the young guys as well, that they've been pushing their case. So it's going to be exciting. Then we've just had to kind of be in a holding pattern for a few weeks. So hopefully we can just maintain that until we get to that first game.
So Chris, put the scheduling to one side and what's going to happen there. You've mentioned a number of times now since we started asking questions about these young guys. What's your expectation around Victorian cricket this year? And what do you think is actually achievable?
Well, we've got 14 players under 23 in the squad. So I think at times, you know, there's going to be some pretty good opportunities for a number of these young players. I think Mitch Perry is one in particular. If he can stay fit, he'll play a lot. And Will Sutherland, also very young. And then there's a couple of the young batsmen as well in Jake Fraser McGurk and John O'Merlo and Mackenzie Harvey. So, it's probably just trying to expose them a little bit, get them some games under their belt and keep building them as players so that they're ready to go when the opportunity presents. But in terms of expectations this year, it's pretty hard to know. I think that with the schedule being the way it is, we'll have to just ride with the punches, as I said. I still think that we've got a very good squad. I mean, our batting, really, it's quite exceptional, really. So I'd like to think that we're going to be competitive. And then hopefully with James Patterson coming into the mix post-BBL, you know, we can really push to get up the top of that ladder.
Now, you mentioned the bowlers and you felt like they didn't have enough bowling under their belt for them to be avoiding injury. But how much more do you think they needed? Was it weeks more? Was it days more? How much more did you think they needed?
How much they need? I mean, I think that they were in a pretty good place when we came here. But it's in terms of you're just trying to get... It's a bit equatable to like running a marathon. You don't just get up one day and run a marathon. You've got to keep building up towards it. And so with this quarantine, it's going to be a bit of a dip too much for them, and they're going to have to kind of build up again in the week leading up to that first game. So yeah, look, I think that being in the quarantine, it's just about not being able to get enough bowling into them and also having enough time on your feet. I mean, you spend most of your time sitting in your room. So, I just don't think that... We don't think that they're going to be just quite ready to go to be able to play a first-class game if we were to come out and have just 2 days before we played that first-class game.
Chris Rogers has joined us on The Breakfast Club on a Monday morning, the coach of the Victorian cricket team. The Shield season starts in 10 days' time for them, and which we're very much looking forward to against the old enemy, New South Wales. And one of the topics always comes up in the last couple of years when talking Victorian cricket, Chris, is Will Pekowski and his preparation for this season. A couple of questions. How has that been going? And B, your first real sight of him up close and personal day in, day out, and what sort of cricketer he is?
I've been really impressed by Will. I think he's had a lot of support now. He's put a lot of quite a good network in around him to help him get through, you know, his the battles that he has. But all the conversations I've had with him have been excellent. You can tell he's a young man with an old head on his shoulders, and he particularly the way I watch him go about his batting, he plays in a really calm manner, which is suited to the long form game. So I'm just hopeful that he can keep managing everything that he needs to and then get out and show just how good he is. Because some of the innings he played at Junction Oval the last few weeks were excellent. So, all the conversations have been excellent. To be honest, I haven't actually seen him since we've been in quarantine because he's been in the groups that go in the afternoon and I've been in the groups that go in the morning. So, I've spoken to him a couple of times on the phone, but that's the kind of things we're dealing with at the moment.
And that's the way that's it's going to be up until the first game, is it? Where you'll be separated until that time.
Yeah. Wow. We actually swapped today. We're a week in. We swapped today, so they'll go in the morning. And I'll go in the afternoon.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.